Welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 37 for February 16th, 2010. My name is Ben Snitkoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabier
and David Liu.
As usual, we've got three stories for you this week. First, White House and whether or not it can exercise copyright on photos taken by the White House photographer. Second, the Olympics and streaming, whether or not it's legal. And what rules of copyright you'd violate if you did try to stream the Olympics. And finally, the FBI and the Fourth Amendment, and whether or not you have a right to privacy in where you are at any given time, assuming you carry around a cell phone. So we're going to start out with the White House and its copyright. So essentially what this story is, there's a professor, and I'm not going to remember which school she's from right now, but she noticed that the White House Flickr pool had a little disclaimer on it. And basically, the White House Flickr pool, when you look at any of the photos, it says, this is a official White House photograph. It's being made available only for publication by news organizations and or personal use.
Printing again, by the subjects of the photograph.
The photograph may not be manipulated in any way. It may not be used in commercial or political materials, advertisements, emails, products, promotions that in any way suggest approval or endorsement of the president, the first family, or the White House. So the person who stumbled across this got a little up in arms about this because the U.S. government cannot hold a copyright in works that it produces. So can Dominic or David? Yeah, how about Dominic? We'll throw this to you first.
Sure.
Why can't the U.S. government hold a copyright in works it creates, and how does this disclaimer in any way violate that rule?
Well, the reason I understand it can't hold the copyright is because it is the U.S. government and it's spending taxpayer money to create these works, so it doesn't make any sense to hold the copyright in them, because the whole point of copyright is it's just not doing a very good job explaining this, but basically the government can't really register a copyright with itself for its own protection from the rest of the country. It's kind of it's the referee in this sense. It's not supposed to play the game as well.
Yeah, it's actually, if I can jump in, it's a statutory thing
Yeah, I was giving you the public policy reasons.
Yeah, it's also that the point of copyright is to ensure that it's to promote the as that would have been called back then, the sciences. To encourage people to create, you know, these creative works, we want to give them a copyright. We want to say that, you know, if you do that, we'll give you the exclusive right for a period of time. But the U.S. government doesn't need that incentive. They're going to be producing these things whether or not they have an exclusive right to copy it or produce it. One great example of that is the 9/11 report, which the U.S. The U.S. published and kept under wraps, and they made a deal, an exclusive deal with one publishing company to put it out first. But once that publishing company put it out, once that text was out there, anybody else could come out and publish it, and indeed several other companies did publish it. I forget what the name of the original publisher was, but after that, the New York Times came out, and they published their own edition, and they added information to it, articles about 9/11 and about the 9/11 Commission report. So I guess my next question here is, why does that disclaimer that we read a minute ago, why does that run afoul of the ban on the United States holding copyrights, if it does at all?
I'm not sure it runs across the ban itself, but it tries to appropriate itself rights that are traditionally held in copyright. So it's trying to carve out part of what's normally held in copyright for itself. It doesn't actually claim copyright, but it's trying to claim the same rights that would be claimed normally under copyright, such as you can't manipulate this photo in any way or use it in these places. That sort of restriction would be valid if they had a copyright, but otherwise they don't really have a basis to make that sort of restriction.
Right, and that would be creation of a derivative work?
Sure. That particular thing, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and I agree with the analysis so far, but I think it's important to look at this and try to determine, you know, what the origin is. So this White House in particular has run up to and I guess as recently as a couple of days ago, three instances of people misappropriating, and I'll go so far as to say misappropriating the president or the first family's image for use in advertising. There was a billboard up in Times Square with the president wearing a coat, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody remember what the brand of that coat was?
It was Weatherproof. The Weatherproof Garment Company had this whole Times Square billboard of Obama's trip to China, where he was wearing one of their coats, and Arguably, it was a very effective advertisement because everybody, at least, I mean, it was press either way, so.
Yeah, had they not taken it down, I would have never heard of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, not only do they have it in the most trafficked intersection in America, but they also got all the news stories about it when the White House asked them to take it down. And I think it's worth noting here that just because you're a public figure, it doesn't mean, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about, you know, your right to, let's say there's a defamation suit, somebody defames you. If you're a public figure, it's a lot harder to prove and get damages from that defamation. I don't think that holds as true with right to publicity. You know, even if you're a public figure, and I'd say even more so if you're a public figure, you have a right to prevent people from using your likeness to advertise products without your permission. And you know, that's what happened here in the Weatherproof case. There was also a case where PETA used a picture of the First Lady, who rather famously does not wear fur. And in that case, the White House also asked, you know, PETA to stop using the First Lady's likeness. And I sent this around to people yesterday. Classesandcareers.com has recently been using the president's likeness in an image. There's a little ad that I guess has been appearing on websites that says, go back to school and get your share of the stimulus money. It's a picture of the president next to three people of various races and genders standing next to the president in mortarboards, looking like they just graduated.
Stock photo.
Yeah, www.stockphoto.org. Anyway. So I think what this disclaimer was trying to do, it was trying to get to the right of publicity. And, you know, while there is some merit in this statement that, you know, this says this photo may not be manipulated in any way, yes, that goes to, you know, a right that I would have. I don't think there would be any problem if I went on to the Flickr site, downloaded one of these photos, and manipulated it. What I think the disclaimer meant to say was, this photograph may not be manipulated in any way. It may not for use and it may not be used in. I'm looking at this disclaimer right now, and I'm trying to tie the commercial use to
right.
the manipulation clause. I think it's just poorly worded.
There's two issues tied up in there. One, there's right of publicity, which the president, just like any other public figure, has, that you can't use his image without his consent, especially to endorse your product. And it's traditionally, and for good reason, the way that presidents don't go around endorsing products, just because it's not becoming of presidents to do so. And they have to wait until their former presidents to go around and advertise that. But it's confusing. There's the copyright issue, which is the derivative work issue, and then there's the right of publicity issue. The right of publicity issue is fine. They can restrict that, but they can't restrict the derivative work issue. Like, that the photograph may not be manipulated in any way. That's just not true.
Like, right.
This is public domain. Anyone can manipulate it if they want. So it's odd to see that language in the disclaimer. But the part about promotional use, that is true. So,
I mean, could that language be put in there to sort of avoid the, you know, certain defamatory manipulations of the president's image? I mean, he has notably been drawn as Hitler or Stalin or whoever. So could this be a reaction to that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. There's also the clause that says this... Let me just find it. It may not be used in political materials, although that's all tied to that suggest in any way the endorsement of the president. As for the defamatory thing, I mean, you could probably burn the president in effigy and it wouldn't be in any way defamatory. I mean, not the actual president. you could burn an effigy of the president. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure the Hitler mustaches aren't even defamatory. That's political speech. It is exceptionally hard to defame the president. You gotta really try in order to have the president bring an actionable claim against you. And even then, I mean, it would be such a thorny issue for the president to actually litigate one of those claims. Because, as we've mentioned again before, a defense to defamation is that, you know, what you're defaming them about is the truth. Like, if I said David Liu is a graduate student at the Wash U in St. Louis. And, you know, David Liu, you were like, oh, God, that's defamatory. I'm going to sue you. I could prove that, you know, that was true. And as a result, it's not defamation. Even if being a graduate student at Wash U is, you know, the worst thing in the world, which it isn't. But I imagine the type of thing that you'd say about the president that would try to, you know, goad him into bringing this suit would be a lot worse. And you wouldn't want to go through a suit where the president wouldn't want to be dragged into a suit where somebody would be trying to prove whatever those terrible allegations were. Dominic, were you trying to say something about 3 minutes ago when I was, before I started?
No, I think we're all good. You covered it pretty much, so.
Okay, David Liu, any last comments before we move on?
No, all set.
Okay, we burned right through that story. So the next story is about streaming in the Olympics, and I have to be honest, I have not watched a minute of the Olympics on TV yet. Call me a bad American, call me, you know...
Well, it's in Canada, so I mean...
Yeah, but I mean, we've already...
It's not about being a bad American, it's about being a bad citizen of the world. That said, I've watched about 3 minutes, so...
I have not watched any of the Olympics either, so...
Yeah, I listened to some coverage on it on NPR, which I guess...
Ooh, that makes me the expert on this, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I know that Apollo Ono won a silver medal, and that some American woman took a gold medal in moguls, stealing it from the grasp of the Canadians who have yet to win a gold medal on their home soil.
But our story is not about whether we've watched the Olympics, but whether we can stream the Olympics.
Right, and specifically, so NPR is not allowing for as NBC rather is not allowing for as much streaming as the Olympics as a lot of people would like. And what brought this particular story up was that I was in a bar a couple of months ago, and somebody was probing me as to whether or not streaming was illegal and whether or not streaming violated copyright, and I assured the person that it certainly did. But when pressed, I was having a little difficulty pigeoning, you know, what copyright it violated. You know, I'm not necessarily it's a tough argument to say that I'm making a copy of the work when I'm streaming it, because, you know, I click a button on a computer and somebody sends me this work, and as it's coming in, it's getting deleted. It's, you know, hardly buffered at all. And there's a case that says if, you know, the buffer is very short, you're not really fixing it in a medium.
It only exists in the memory of your computer. It's not actually being stored on your hard drive at all. And it's a rather temporary existence, yeah. So.
Right, but there are also cases that say if you have a full copy in the memory of your computer, that's a copyright violation. For instance, whenever I load a program into my computer, you know, if I double-clicked on Skype to launch Skype, I made a copy of Skype when it copied the code of Skype into my RAM. And because it's a fixed copy in the RAM and it's going to stay there for a while, that's a copy under the Copyright Act. But there's, as I was mentioning, it's a case called Cablevision that says if you're only storing... in this case, it was a TV show. They were buffering a TV show for at most like a second and a half. I think it was even a fraction of a second. And that didn't constitute making a copy in the views of the court. Now, there's a fair argument that the court was wrong there. But, you know, if that's not – if making that very short copy, making a copy not of the entire work but of sections of the work and only buffering it for a short period of time, if that's not a copy under the Copyright Act – How is streaming violating the Copyright Act? Dominic?
If it's not a copy for it to be briefly in, is what you're saying?
Right, or to... And we're not even talking about the whole work. We're talking about a buffer of a short chunk of the work at any given time.
Well, it's kind of a murky area, I guess, in that sense. It's a copyright violation of that particular short piece of the work.
Right, but, you know, there's an argument that that's a de minimis copyright violation. If I'm buffering, you know, a half second of this work at a time and playing it back and then deleting it, it's a tough...
You could argue that the aggregation of the various
I think was the word you were looking
yes,
for.
Yes, de minimis parts. You could argue that the accumulation of the little pieces together make a violation. I mean, the court would probably say, all right, well, on the level here, we're looking at, okay, 2 seconds, 2 seconds, 2 seconds, but added it up together and we have a 3-hour broadcast.
Right. The other thing that I was thinking is, at least from the position of the person who set up the stream, this is arguably a public performance. You know, one of the rights reserved to a copyright holder is the right to perform the copyrighted work publicly, or even to broadcast the work. How do you think that argument plays out?
Let's maybe narrow this hypo down. Let's say I'm in Canada and I have a stream of the, or I have a broadcast of the internet, a broadcast of the Olympics that Canadian television is playing now. NBC isn't going to play it until 3 hours later because they're time shifting everything for the West Coast. So I log on to a website and start pumping up the broadcast of what I see on my Canadian television to the internet so people can watch my TV over my shoulder in some sense. I'm broadcasting what's on my TV. That is a public performance of the Canadian television broadcast. It'd be just as if I taped the broadcast, invited my 1,000 closest friends and said, "Hey guys, we're going to watch this." It's the same reason that my undergraduate dorm actually got in trouble a couple years ago, because we would invite people over to movies and the studios somehow got wind of this and they said, "Hey guys, you can't do that. That's a public performance. You don't have a license to do that." So we had to stop doing that. So,
but for a stream, does it matter that only one person is viewing, you know, the end part of a stream at any time? I mean, it's not like it's not like this is Say Anything and I'm standing, you know, in the town square with a TV above my head, you know, showing it to everybody who walks by.
Does it matter that only one person can see the public performance, or does it matter that potentially multiple people could see the public performance? I mean, I don't think the law is going to come down on the side of, well, only one person watched it. It's going to be more potentially many people could watch it. It was open to the public in that sense.
Right, I think you're right there. And I think my argument, even to narrow it down a little more, was not that just one person was watching it, but, you know, one person, you know, a stream, it starts at the person who's streaming it, and then it goes to individually to many different points. It's not like a radio broadcast where it's the one broadcast that's going out all around and everyone's picking up on it. Each stream is a different, you know, individual, I don't even know what the right word to say is that's not stream. It's an individual set of streaming of
point cast
going.
Point cast, I think, is the word you're looking
point
for.
Point cast, yeah.
So yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say it is a direct connection under most internet technologies, although there is some research that's going on that would allow it to be a more general, more general performance. But
I'm sorry, like a BitTorrent for live streams.
I mean, it's essentially changing the way the packets are routed on the inner tubes, changing it so that it doesn't go from where, let's say I was broadcasting, it doesn't go straight from me and then to Ben, and then if I was also going to Dominic, it wouldn't go straight from me to Dominic, it would go from me to someplace in the greater Boston area and then split. So it was just minor technical note is that, you know, there is talk of that sort of research, that sort of live, I guess that more public performance is out there, just doesn't exist yet, and I don't think anyone's really considered the copyright ramifications of that.
Wow, that's really interesting. Going from a standpoint of, you know, I don't know for sure. I think Comcast is playing with ways of, it's either Comcast or Time Warner, is playing with ways of letting people stream online any TV that they subscribe to through their cable service. So let's say it's Time Warner. That would be a great way for Time Warner to have, you know, one centralized hub that serves all of this TV to, you know, whatever their regions are. I know they're in upstate New York. I think they're on the West Coast. So serving it to those areas and then branching out from there, that's a really interesting technology. Thank you, David Liu.
Yeah. I mean, and the more computer science-y half of it is that the more people that sort of see the same stream, the less the tubes are clogged, so to say. I mean, the less traffic that has to go over it, in that if I send it all the way to Boston just once, it's a lot less than sending it to the both of you individually. Whether right. that makes it a public performance or not, I guess, is the more pressing question.
And I think the even more important question is whether or not you could explain it to a judge in a way that the judge would understand what was going on and then could make an informed ruling based on that. I'm a little bitter because I read an opinion recently that used email and scare quotes.
Email and scare quotes?
Yes, as in electronic mail. Email. There's no reason to do that.
If you couldn't see it, Ben was doing the air quotes.
Air quotes, yeah. technically Liz not yet available for video streaming because of copyright considerations.
No, we're Creative Commons. If you wanna add video to our stream, you know, your own reproduction of our podcast with actors, I think
you're
feel
welcome
free.
To.
Oh man, any more thoughts on this case? Anything anyone wants to bring up legally or not legally? Dominic,
I guess,
or David, since you started, you go first.
So the main question here was whether or not watching the Olympics online is legal. We should caveat that there are a number of live streams available online on NBCOlympics.com. It would look like, I'm just looking at it now, and it looks like I could be watching U.S. versus Canada, or U.S. versus China women's ice hockey right now. I think the core issue here is actually how much they're broadcasting and whether or not there are other means to obtain things that NBC Olympics is not choosing to broadcast, because they are broadcasting some things.
Right, and I guess we should have made that more clear at the outset. It would be absolutely legal for you to watch one of NBC's streams in the United States. The question is, would it be legal for you to watch an unauthorized stream in the United States? And I would say no. Both the streamer would be liable for either direct infringement or induced infringement in the United States, depending on what happens, and you as the viewer would also be, I think, liable for direct infringement. Dominic, do you agree with that?
Yes.
So don't do it. I mean, it would be hard as heck to catch you, but...
What I think is actually interesting is if you go to the official Olympic site and try to watch one of their official streams, they ask you to enter your cable television information, like what your cable provider is, because they partnered with cable providers, but only... So they'll do internet streams, but you have to tell them that you subscribe to a cable provider in order to do it. I mean, from a user interface perspective, it's kind of annoying because you're like, oh, I'll go watch this video, and you get hit with this pop-up and say select your cable provider, and it's like, oh, well, I don't really care that much. I mean, at least that was my reaction. I was like, okay, well, I don't want to look up what details or whatever. I'll just not watch the video. But they do make it available for your cable providers. So.
Also, assuming that you install Microsoft Silverlight, which is a whole different can of worms, but...
Yeah, I remember, what was it, 2 years ago when they made the deal for Silverlight for the Winter Olympics, and they thought that Silverlight was going to catch on and set the world on fire. Instead, HTML5 came out, and now I think the only two things that use Silverlight are Netflix streaming and NBC for the Olympics.
Yeah, I reluctantly installed Silverlight because of Netflix streaming.
I think Major League Baseball does too, but I guess that was hyperbole to say that it is just two things that use Silverlight.
Okay, there may be a couple of others. Yeah, for MLB, I've always used... they have a downloadable app that I've really enjoyed using. Anyway, okay, so any last thoughts, Dominic?
All set here.
David Liu?
No.
Okay, we are going to proceed to our last story of the week, which is also our first non-copyright-related story. This is about the Fourth Amendment. So a couple of years ago, in fact, in 2007, the FBI applied for what's called historic location information. So I guess I got to back up and talk a little bit about how cell phones work. So I assume everyone listening has some sort of cellular mobile device currently on their person or that they use every day. The way these work is that every 7 seconds, they send a ping back and forth from the nearest cell tower to your phone. And this is so that if there's a phone call coming in for you, the phone company doesn't have to send the phone call to every tower on their network. They can just look up where you were most recently within the last 7 seconds and send the phone call to that tower. And, I mean, there's obviously a lot of reasons why they do that. But the downside is that they store that information, and as a result... this varies, I guess, from cell company to cell company. But if you have somebody's cell phone number and the access to this information, you can figure out where somebody's been within between 3 miles and about 50 feet. So 3 miles would be in rural areas where there are not very many cell towers. In dense urban areas, using only the cell tower information. You can locate people within about 200 feet, and using GPS information, you can get it down to 50 feet or less as to, you know, where they are. And the FBI, you know, found this out and absolutely love cell phones, because what they can do is they can go to your cell phone company and say, listen, we're doing an investigation. We're pretty sure that, you know, this person is involved in some sort of criminal activity, and we want to figure out where they've been, you know, historically for the past year. You know, give us your cell phone information for that time. And the way they did this was using a provision in the Stored Communications Act, and we've talked about that before, and it's kind of ancillary to what we're talking about today, so I don't want to go into it in too much detail. But the Stored Communication Act allows for the government to get certain stored electronic communications from whoever's storing that data. And it has many different ways in which you can get that data. One of those ways is what's called a D order. I don't have the exact section in front of me, but essentially it says that the U.S. government can get that information from you, can get can get information from somebody who's storing the electronics, the data that you want, on a showing that, you know, this is with articulable suspicion that this is going to come. Hey, Dominic just sent me this. Requirements for court orders. Okay. You basically need to make a showing that this information is related to an ongoing investigation. But what's important is that this isn't the same standard. In fact, it's a significantly lower standard than what you'd normally need for a warrant. And what happened is the FBI applied to get this information, and a district court judge, specifically a magistrate judge, it's not a terribly important detail. If Dave Liu really wants to know the difference, we'll get into it. Otherwise, we'll just say a judge denied it. A judge denied it and said, you know what, you need probable cause for this. And the FBI has appealed this up to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So, Dominic did some digging for me. This is 18 U.S.C. 2703 Section D. That's the specific provision. So what are your quick thoughts about this before we dive back into more of the legal thicket here?
To give the really high-level perspective that might have just been lost in that law avalanche of law, basically the FBI wants to be able to access what they call non-content information from cell phones. And non-content data includes your location. Not what you're saying, not who you're talking to, just where you are. And they'd like to be able to access this without any need for probable cause.
Yeah, or generally without a warrant.
Right. Which, if you stop and think about it, is kind of scary in that they could theoretically know where everyone who has a cell phone is at any time.
Yeah, they do need to have some showing. It's not a very strong showing. It's, you know, they need to have I've seen the standard be described differently, but it's essentially articulable facts showing that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the contents of this communication are relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation.
Right, but, oh, you're talking about the actual data itself, not the contents of the cell phone communication.
Right. Okay. To get the data, they need, that's the showing that they need to get this, that the FBI thinks that they need to get this, the location information. And one of the things that the magistrate judge noted in denying the FBI's request for a court order to get this information was that you can tell a lot. I mean, assuming that they can dive down and, you know, find with your location within 50 feet, that'll tell the FBI, you know, if they do a little investigation on the back end, where you live, where you work, where you go to pray, yeah, where you go for AA meetings. You know, if they know, I mean, basically who you associate with and when. There's a lot of relatively protected information and information for which people have a privacy interest. You know, yes, the FBI could do the same thing by putting a tail on somebody, but the trade-off is you have to put a tail on somebody. You need to commit to man hours, somebody to follow you around.
Okay. Not an actual tail like they pin on. Okay.
No.
I got it.
Yeah. Somebody following you around, there's a risk of detection. There's the man hours that they have to put into that. And the judge said that it's not fair that you guys should be able to just make a slight, you know, meet this low standard and then get all that information. Now, I do want to point out that the FBI in all of these proceedings has said, we only use this standard, we only use this method of getting it when we're looking for what they're calling historic information, information of where you've been. If they want constant updates on not only where you've been, but where you're going and where you are currently, they call that perspective information, they say that it's proper to require a warrant for that. I don't really see the difference. You know, knowing where you are at any given time, that's I guess it's more useful, but why should where you are right now have any greater privacy interest? Why should you have any greater privacy interest in where you are right now than where you were yesterday?
Especially since having a lot of data can let them look at and see habits and...
Right, exactly.
And I mean, is there a clear line what is history? I mean, 5 minutes ago was history in some sense. I mean, can they just say that, you know, 5 minutes ago, oh, that's historical information, I can just grab that?
I think the way they're describing that, defining that, is saying that, you know, historical information is anything before we submit the court order. And prospective information would be asking for constant information from when we submit the court order or ask for the warrant forward. So that would be how they're defining it. So, you know, okay. Yes, where I was 5 minutes ago is historic, but unless you file the court order now, you don't get that information from 5 minutes ago.
I thought it was pretty interesting. One thing the prosecutor for the FBI put in the brief: one who does not wish to disclose his movements to the government need not use a cellular telephone.
Yeah, that's that seems totally reasonable, because I know that many people our age are still using landlines regularly and don't, in fact, use cell phones exclusively. Dominic, do you have a landline?
I do not have a landline. Well, I think we do, because Comcast gave us one, whether we wanted one or not, because it was cheaper to have it as part of their triple play deal or something, but no one ever uses it. So,
David Liu, do you have a landline?
I have a landline in my office, which I have used all of twice.
Yeah, I use my office phone strictly for intra-office communication. I think I've called out with that phone maybe twice, but everything else I just use my cell phone.
So the government is basically arguing, though, that there is no privacy interest here, because they're saying that, or it's not a strong enough privacy interest to make the government show cause with probable cause. They're saying that if you willingly make a phone call using a cell phone, you realize that you're broadcasting your location to the cell tower, and therefore you're not assuming the risk that the FBI might, you're not assuming that the FBI might be listening to what you're saying, but you are assuming that that information as to where you are is freely available to anyone.
Well, it's not even making the call, right? It's just having your phone on so that they can call you.
Right.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's any time your phone is turned on, it's going to be making these pings to the...
Right. Basically, the government is arguing here that you have no right to privacy with where you are because you're voluntarily disclosing it to the cell phone service provider by having a cell phone.
Right. And yes, I think that's exactly the argument they're making. There's some precedent for this. So there's no privacy interest in where a car is if the car's on the road. So the government can put, at least in federal law, the federal government could put a GPS tracker on your car and track the whereabouts of your car at all times. And that's not a problem, because when your car's on the road, that's open to the public. Anyone can see that. The thing that worries me about this is that it'll also report the phone's location when the phone is in some place where you have a high privacy interest, which is in your house. And I actually posted a short story about this earlier in the week, I guess last week when this gets released. But essentially, there was a case in the 80s, I think it was 84, in which the Supreme Court said that, you know, sure, you can put a tracking device, in this case it was a big 50-gallon jug of ether, barrel of ether. But what you can't do is put it in there, wait for the person to drive to their house, and then use your tracking device to figure out what house that ether's in, because essentially you couldn't do that search. You couldn't search the person's house to see where the ether is without a warrant. And I don't see an important difference between that And when my phone's in my pocket, the FBI using that phone to see, I mean, so technically they're just finding where my phone is, but there's a darn good chance that wherever my phone is, that's where I am right now. So by, you know, releasing that information, the FBI knows essentially when I'm in my house. You know, even if it's just historical information, that's not information, that's still information that I have a privacy interest in. Does that argument make sense, guys?
Sure, in that we have a higher interest in privacy when we're home.
Right, and you have a higher interest of privacy in things in your home. So the, in fact, the federal government and any government would, with limited, very, very limited exceptions, pretty much always need a warrant to search your home, unless you give them consent, or, you know, I think one of the other exceptions is hot pursuit. You know, if I just committed a bank robbery and they see me running into my house, they can follow me into my house, but there are very, very, very limited circumstances where the government's allowed to come into your home without consent or without a warrant. And this is essentially violating that. This is saying that they can do a search of your home, even if it's a historical search of your home, without a warrant.
But they're not searching your home so much. They're just noting that you were in your home.
Yes, but again, this is it. The case that I was talking about, it's called Caro. They weren't searching that person's home. They were determining whether or not a 50-gallon drum of ether was in the person's home. That's not really searching the home, according to your logic, is it, Dominic?
No, I see your point.
Yeah,
I mean, searching means discovering some object in the confines of that building, and I don't know. I think that discovering that you, or at least your cell phone, is within this building constitutes search, at least in my layman's perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you'd be correct.
Right, and I'll note that the case that I've been talking about, Caro, was a sharply divided case. I believe the outcome was something like 4-1-4, so the judges were split three ways on the reasoning, but came out to the result that this would have been a search. So there's no way of knowing what the current Supreme Court would do with a similar case.
Just to get back to the sort of fundamental argument that they're making here, I don't think that most people, when they purchase a cell phone, make that sort of realization that by purchasing this device, the company that I'm buying it from not only knows where I am in order to connect me to a phone call, but also, you know, that they might give this information out to other people and that it's constantly tracking me even when I'm not on the phone, things like that. Like, I just don't think that most people are thinking through that far. I don't know. Does that mirror what you guys think?
The government kind of draws the analogy to the olden days where you would have a landline telephone, and they said that you don't have a privacy interest in the numbers that you dial out of the phone, because it's obvious that you have to convey them to the phone company for them to connect you, and thus you assume the risk that law enforcement is going to ask the phone company what those numbers are. Similarly, the argument here is you assume the risk by using the cell phone technology of your location being potentially, it is necessarily passed on to the company, because otherwise how would they know where you are to send the signal to you, or not exactly in those terms technologically, but they have to know where you are in order to connect the phone to you. And it's possible that they could pass that on to the government as well.
Right. There's an interesting dichotomy here between what people think they have privacy in and what they actually have privacy in. The technical standard to use when determining whether or not something is a search is whether or not you've got a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. And it's a constitutional term of art. That's not the actual test. Like in tort law, when you're dealing with negligence, it's, you know, the standard is a reasonably prudent person. And the thing is, a reasonably prudent person occasionally takes cell phone calls while he's driving in a car. But if you hit somebody when you're driving in your car talking on your cell phone, chances are a jury's going to find that you weren't a reasonably prudent person. It's one of these weird things where, yeah, yes, we all think that we have a privacy interest in, you know, something, but it turns out when the Supreme Court looks at it, they determine that you don't, because it's clearly that any reasonably prudent person wouldn't say that. It's a very weird balance that they have there. I'm pretty much tapped out on this, and I know we're running a little short, but does anybody else have anything to add? Dominic?
All set.
David Liu.
I think the key ramification here is that in allowing this to exist, it enables the plots of many, many SVU episodes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's only a limited amount. It's a short period of time before we see this ripped from the headlines. And I'll note that I've done some work on criminal cases where I've actually seen these records from the cell phone company that say, you know, such and such a time the person was in, you know, say Boston, Massachusetts, and then such and such a time when the alleged crime occurred, he was in Springfield, and then, you know, a few hours later he was back in Boston. So, you know, these things are used, but my impression is that they're typically you typically get a warrant for this sort of information. It's not this lower standard that the government seeks to hit. So this case was actually argued before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, I think in Philadelphia. It was argued this past Friday, which would have been the 12th, February 12th. And we'll obviously keep an ear to the ground for any murmurs of how the oral argument went, or in the alternative, you know, if we don't hear anything until the opinion comes out, we'll definitely cover the opinion. I'd like to remind everyone that David O'Brien, who's not here today, and I were on Twill, This Week in Law, this past week. So we'd urge you to go over to that website, twit.org/Twill, and twit.tv/Twill, and check out the This Week in Law podcast. Some great friends of ours were with us there, and we really enjoyed ourselves. And I'd like to say please visit our website too, technicallylegal.org, or on Twitter @TechLegal. And if you have any questions or comments, please email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org. And in wrapping up then, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David Liu.
Thanks for listening. Do you know what I heard recently and I didn't know until then, until I had heard it? PageRank, the Google ranking system, is named after Larry Page. It's not that it ranks pages. I mean, it does, but it's the page in PageRank comes from Larry Page's name.
I did not know that. Yeah, it is, according to Wikipedia. Boom.
Now